In the first Taisho on the Diamond Sutra, we looked at the nature of the sutra as the Dharma thread that extends throughout all space and time. We saw that Subhuti, the elder, saw for the first time his own Buddha nature and that of all beings in the ordinary activities of everyday life. He praises the Buddha's teaching and begs for further instruction. How does one walk, stand, and control the mind in this life of coming and going? The Buddha validates Subhuti's insight and sees that he can now receive the full teaching. Chapter 3. The Buddha said, Subhuti, those who would take the Bodhisattva path should direct their minds thus. All living beings, in whatever realms they might exist, whether they are born from an egg, born from a womb, born from water, or born from the air, whether they have form or no form, whether they have thought or no thought, or have neither thought nor no thought, in whatever conceivable realm of being, in the realm of complete nirvana, I shall liberate them all. And though I thus liberate countless beings, not a single being is liberated. And why not? Subhuti, a bodhisattva who creates the perception of a being cannot be called a bodhisattva. And why not? Subhuti, no one can be called a bodhisattva who creates the delusive image about a self, about other, about existence in space, or about existence in time. The Buddha answers a question, but which question? Not the one about how to live, stand, or walk, but about how to handle the mind. That's the important one. In the verse to case number 9 in the Wu Men Quan, read, better than knowing the body is knowing the mind at peace. When the mind is realized, the body is no longer distressed. When body and mind are fully realized, the saintly hermit ignores worldly power. If the mind is disciplined and calm, standing, walking, everything else follows naturally. Those who would take the bodhisattva path should direct their minds thus. Directing the mind. How do we do that? When Zhao Zhou asked Nanchuan, should I try to direct myself towards it? Nanchuan said, if you try to direct yourself towards it, you go away from it. Is this business of directing our minds about attaching to a particular thought? In our Zen sect, we are told that thoughts come and go, and we should not cling to any of them. What then is this directing the mind? It is the basic discipline of our sect, of Buddhism. To direct the mind is another term for practice. To direct the mind is to steady the mind and focus it. It is to focus clearly and accurately on the practice. Where have we heard that before? This is cultivation. This is the antithesis of the popular notion of the Zen thing, the undirected, undisciplined mind, flying off in all directions, grabbing here and there and everywhere, completely at the mercy of the three poisons of greed, hatred, and ignorance. We direct the mind in our practice. We direct the mind as our practice. In breathing mu, we direct the mind. In following or counting the breath, we direct the mind. In just sitting, we direct the mind. So Buddha gives his bodhisattvas a practice of directing the mind thus. All living beings in whatever realms they might exist, whether they are born from an egg, born from a womb, born from water, or born from the air, whether they have form or no form, whether they have thought or no thought, or have neither thought nor no thought, in whatever conceivable realm of being, in the realm of complete nirvana, I shall liberate them all. And though I thus liberate countless beings, not a single being is liberated. One can go on and enumerate in great detail what it means to be born from egg, womb, water, etc., and what it is to have thought or no thought, and so on. But the real point is this. All beings, without exception, regardless of origin, stage, or condition, I liberate them all, and yet not a single being is liberated. This is how we direct the mind. Thus the Tathagata protects and cares for the bodhisattvas, and thus he teaches all bodhisattvas. All beings without exception, regardless of origin, stage, or condition, I liberate them all, and yet not a single being is liberated. This thought arises even as you hear it spoken. You are not separate from it. Buddha is not separate from it. Mu is not separate from this thought. This thought transcends thought or no thought. And yet the first of the bodhisattva vows is the many beings are numberless, I vow to liberate them. The third general resolution is, I resolve to liberate the many beings. All those beings to liberate. How will I ever live long enough to accomplish that? But you see, we are now falling into the error and the notion of beings separate from ourselves that need liberating. But the Buddha explains, a bodhisattva who creates the perception of a being cannot be called a bodhisattva. And why not? No one can be called a bodhisattva who creates the delusive image about a self, about other, about existence in space, or about existence in time. Self, other, existence in space, existence in time. These are the four images, or the four forms. They are the delusive images that limit us and block our bodhisattva path. The self-other dichotomy imprisons us in isolation from our true, unlimited Buddha nature, which is not separate from the universe. We live in the illusion of an I in here and an other out there. Existence in space and time is another limitation. In space, we limit beings to certain arbitrarily defined physical boundaries. It's rather like one of those open space designed houses where we say, okay, the living room starts here and the dining room is over here and so forth, just for convenience. In time, we limit all beings, including ourselves, to a certain lifespan. That which is born must necessarily die. Our Buddha nature transcends all considerations of space and time. It was never born and cannot die. We will return to these four limitations, or delusive images, again and again in this sutra, each time at a deeper, more subtle level. If these delusive images are let go, then there is no notion about a separate ego I, no other, no notion about anything that exists or does not exist in space or in time. Then there is not a single being to be liberated. And with this realization, all beings are liberated. Chapter 4. Furthermore, Subhuti, when bodhisattvas practice dana, the mind should not attach to anything. They should practice dana without attaching to sound, smell, taste, touch, feelings, or dharmas, i.e. phenomena. Subhuti, they should practice dana like this without attaching to appearances, false notions of form. Why? Because if a bodhisattva practices dana without attachment, the body of merit is immeasurable and inconceivable. Subhuti, what do you think? Can you measure out the extent of space in the east? No, Bhagavan, I cannot. The Buddha said, likewise, can you measure out the extent of space in the south, west, and north, as well as in the half points on the compass, and also the zenith and the nadir? No, but Bhagavan, I cannot. The Buddha said, so it is, Subhuti. The body of merit of a bodhisattva who practices dana without attachment is equally immeasurable and inconceivable. Thus, Subhuti, those who take up the way of the bodhisattva should practice dana without being attached to appearances or false notions of form. When bodhisattvas practice dana, the mind should not attach to anything. They should practice dana without attaching to sound, smell, taste, touch, feelings, or dharmas. They should practice dana like this without attaching to appearances. Most translators render the word dana as charity, alms, or almsgiving. But concepts of giving, alms, or charity all imply subject and object, one being giving to another. One gives, another receives. One confers benefits, another is benefited. But this is really about the practice of dana. Dana is relinquishment. Relinquishment has no object. Dana paramita, the transcendent perfection of dana, is the first of the paramitas, or of transcendent perfections. Here's a dialogue between Baijiang and a questioning monk. Question. By what means can the gateway of our school be entered? Answer. By means of dana paramita. Question. According to the Buddha, the bodhisattva path comprises 6 paramitas. Why then have you mentioned only the one? Please explain why this one alone provides a sufficient means for us to enter. Answer. Deluded people fail to understand that the other 5 all proceed from the dana paramita, and by its practice, all the others are fulfilled. Question. Why is it called the dana paramita? Answer. Dana means relinquishment. Question. Relinquishment of what? Answer. Relinquishment of the dualism of opposites. Question. Which means? Answer. It means total relinquishment of ideas as to the dual nature of good and bad, being and non-being, love and aversion, void and non-void, concentration and distraction, pure and impure. By giving them all up, we attain to a state in which all opposites are seen as void. The real practice of dana paramita entails achieving this state without any thoughts of, now I have relinquished all of them. Baijiang goes on to, at great length, to make clear just how the practice of Dhanaparamita fulfills all the other paramitas, including the precepts, concentration, samadhi, and wisdom. Nothing is left out. Dana, then, is the liberation of all beings, all that breathes and does not breathe. Thus, Dhanaparamita is another word for enlightenment. If the Bodhisattva has truly let go of the four delusive images about self, other, existence in space, and existence in time, Dhanaparamita, the transcendent perfection of total relinquishment, naturally follows. Dana does not discriminate between giver, receiver, or that which is given. This is called the three emptinesses. Giver is empty, receiver is empty, the act of giving is empty. Therefore, dana is directionless. In the Christian tradition, there's the story of the widow's mite, in which after many well-to-do folk donate goodly amounts of money into the synagogue treasury, a poor widow comes along and throws in two mites, the smallest possible denomination. And Jesus instructs his disciples, "This poor widow hath cast in more than all they which have cast into the treasury. For all they did cast in of their abundance, but she of her want did cast in all that she had, even all her living." She cast in all of her living, all of her life. This is not just about money. In the practice of dana, we give up everything to this very moment. This is sacrifice to make sacred. But it cannot be self-sacrifice. For if there is a self that sacrifices, or that is sacrificed, we are still bound by notions of self, other, existence in space and time. To give of our abundance is good. To give of our poverty, of our emptiness, is better. If a bodhisattva practices dana without attachment, the body of merit is immeasurable and inconceivable. There is no notion of one who benefits as separate from one who gives. All benefit equally and without limit, and all gain merit equally and without limit. Emperor Wu of Yang asked Bodhidharma what merit he had acquired by building temples and translating sutras. Bodhidharma said, "No merit whatever." Wu's problem with it was that he was asking not about merit in the sense of dana, but about good karma, a very different thing. Karma is limited. X number of good or bad deeds produces X amount of good or bad karma. The quantities are finite, and all karma is eventually exhausted. A finite, limited act cannot produce infinite, unlimited merit. Any act that is constrained by the four delusive images will produce limited karma. So the Buddha asks, "Subhuti, what do you think? Can you measure out the extent of space in the east?" "No, Bhagavan, I cannot." The Buddha said, "Likewise, can you measure out the extent of space in the south, west, and north, as well as in the half points on a compass, and also the zenith and the nadir?" "No, Bhagavan, I cannot." The Buddha said, "So it is, Subhuti. The body of merit of a bodhisattva who practices dana without attachment is equally immeasurable and inconceivable. Thus, those who take up the way of the bodhisattva should practice dana without being attached to appearances or false notions of form." the body of merit. What do we mean by that? It is not about merit as opposed to something else. It's not a bunch of gold stars that we get in the karmic record book. We sometimes refer to the works of a composer or a writer as his or her body of work. That body of work is not just what has been written down and published. That body manifests every time someone picks up a copy of a book or hears the music or sees a work of art. And that manifestation takes place not in the art or in the book or in Springsteen's guitar. It takes place in our own mind. It takes place in mind. So it is with this sutra. The reading, speaking, or studying of this sutra is its manifestation in and of our own mind. That is to say, it is the manifestation of Buddha in the universe as the universe. Our practice of dana, relinquishment, is also like that. It takes place in mind. It takes place as mind, as Buddha, as the universe. If I ask how tall is that building over there, you can give me a perfectly reasonable, finite answer. On the other hand, if I ask how high is up, can you answer that in any rational way? Asking about the merit of dana is like that. It's like asking how big is the sky or how far is space. Not only can you not answer, but the question itself doesn't really make any sense. Even terms like infinite or never-ending don't reach it. Thus we say the body of merit that comes from dana is inconceivable and immeasurable. Chapter 5. Subhuti, what do you think? Can the Tathagata be seen by means of form? Subhuti replied, "No, Bhagavan. The Tathagata cannot be seen by means of form. Why? When the Tathagata speaks of form, it is not form." The Buddha said to Subhuti, "All forms are elusive. If all forms are seen as illusion, then the Tathagata can be seen." So the Buddha asks, "What do you think? Can the Tathagata be seen by means of form?" Every time the Buddha asks, "What do you think?" he is saying, in effect, "What thoughts are you entertaining? Where are the attachments now and the hang-ups? What do we need to work on now?" The Buddha is engaging in a lapidary process, grinding away the sticking points, refining and polishing Subhuti's and our understanding. So now the question: can Buddha, enlightenment, reality, any phenomena be seen, heard, smelled, tasted, touched, imagined, thought about, or in any way perceived or conceived? Can our true nature be grasped? Is there anything to be grasped or anyone to do the grasping? And Subhuti answers, "No, Bhagavan, the Tathagata cannot be seen by means of form." Why? When the Tathagata speaks of form, it is not form. If we say, as Subhuti is saying here, that the Tathagata cannot be seen by means of form, that leaves us with nothing. No Buddha, no teaching. What good is that? The Buddha corrects this. All forms are elusive. If all forms are seen as illusion, then the Tathagata can be seen. That's a really important point. All forms are elusive. Not existing, not existing, just elusive. But then he continues, if all forms are seen as illusion, then the Tathagata can be seen. How many times are we asked in Doksan, where do you see Jiaozhou? Where do you see the Buddha? And on and on. When we speak of form, it is not form. The moment we speak, think, conceive, imagine, or contemplate any object, we are lost. But yet the Buddha spoke of many things. How so? There is no attachment. This sutra is no attachment. Jiaozhou is not attached to mu. If we attach to forms, characteristics, or attributes, we immediately create something that has them. By not attaching to forms, characteristics, or attributes, we strip them away and we see their Buddha nature. We see Buddha nature. All forms are empty, even the form of the Buddha. And together with all beings, we realize the way.